Well, we're trying to understand 20th century thought, and I have suggested to you that one broad way in which you can divide the strands of 20th century thought is to think about philosophies which continue to work in the grand manner, if you will, philosophies that tried to give something of a balanced, public, and systematic answer to the classic questions. And we can list a few of those. The first and perhaps the most impressive for its creativity is process philosophy. We said process philosophy makes its center concept for explanation and its view of the world, what is central to what reality is, events. A second strand in 20th century thought that we have noted is the continuation of idealism, or if you will, a neo-Hegelian idealism. And in the case of idealism, the center explanatory notion and what is at the heart of reality is idea, or if you will, consciousness. And thirdly, which is where we pick up this morning, 20th century has experienced the philosophy of personalism. And I have, unlike your textbook author, I have made it a separate category from idealism, but you need to understand that it is closely related to idealism. Let me, for the sake of completing what we have up here on the board, just say, in terms of overall summary, personalism holds that all explanation must be related to personal factors, and that reality is, at base, person or personal. So we continue to see a feature that was noted already in 19th century philosophy. You may recall that when I had my diagram up on the board of 19th century philosophy, I said, look at the various factors of human nature that seem to be isolated and then idolized by different schools of thought, as though they could take that feature of reality and make it the central one. So the romanticist, you know, emphasized emotion and empathy, a direct intuition. The idealist emphasized reason. Schopenhauer emphasized will. In the case of Nietzsche, will to power. In the case of Kierkegaard, it's decision or doing, the committed approach. And so all of these different approaches in the 19th century, if you get far enough away from the details, you begin to see, well, it's like they idolize this aspect of reality or of human reality, and then another school idolizes that. Well, in the 20th century, we continue to see this, and that the process school says we ought to think in terms of events. The idealists continue to say we should think in terms of reason or idea. And the personalists now tell us that, no, really the key to reality is person. And although this is, of the three that are on the board, personalism would be the least followed. I mean, I don't know that anybody explicitly would call themselves a personalist philosopher today. That school has pretty much withered or died out. I believe that from a Christian standpoint, what personalism says in abstract, not the detailed philosophies of the different personalists, but the abstract notion has something to offer to us as Christians. Because unlike every other worldview, we as Christians take a personal approach to reality. We don't believe that first you have the Big Bang and you have atoms and so forth, or matter in motion, and all these things that do not have volition, do not have personality, do not have emotion, do not have interpersonal possibilities, dialogical possibilities, and all those. We don't think that the inert matter that is in the universe is the most basic reality. Because all that's in this universe, think about just rocks, if you will, and sand and so forth. All those things with which you cannot have a conversation, that show no personality, don't make decisions, and that sort of thing. All those sorts of things are the creation of the personal God. That the impersonal things, we maintain, come from the personal. So reality is eternally and ultimately personal. It's God. And God has made us a small replica, if I can be over general, of Him. He's made us His image in the midst of the world of rocks and trees and sands and seas. So we have a personal nature because we're made in the likeness of God, and God is the ultimate reality. So all I want to say here is, though I'm not going to endorse personalism as a philosophy, I do want you to see the value of personalism. The personalist holds, as I've already said, that the metaphysical ultimate is personal. It is the final explanatory principle. Everything that's going to be explained will eventually have to be related to something personal, volitional. Now, Borden Parker Bowen, B-O-W-N-E, perhaps the best known of the personalists, called this school of thought personal idealism. So that just emphasizes again that it's very close to the idealistic approach to philosophy, but the emphasis here is placed not on idea, but on person. It's a passing in probably trivial detail, but personalism in America had as its primary place of propagation Boston University. However, the secondary place and where the journal, The Personalist, began to be published was the University of Southern California, where the seminar room is still called Bowen Hall, that's where I got my PhD, and so I have not only a Christian interest in personalism, but I have just this passing historical interest that at one time USC was something of a center of personalist philosophy. Personalism gives idealism a particular twist, and in America especially, personalism came to be the most popular version of idealism. The neo-Hegelian versions are represented, but it's mainly in Britain that you got neo-Hegelian idealism, and in America, it was primarily personalistic idealism, or personalism. The term personalism was apparently coined by A.B. Alcott in 1863, and I'm going to quote him. "It is the doctrine that the ultimate reality of the world is a divine person who sustains the universe by a continuous act of creative will." Once again, it is the doctrine that the ultimate reality of the world is a divine person who sustains the universe by a continuous act of creative will. The term appears again in a well-known literary work, many of you may have read it, Walt Whitman's essay entitled Personalism from 1868. For those personalists who are theists, it is wrong to conceive of God as an abstract principle. The neo-Hegelians, like F.H. Bradley, of course, either reject the idea of God, or that is a personal God as in Christianity that's related to the world, or they identify God with the absolute. But the absolute, since it embraces all contrast, cannot be personal over against impersonal. The absolute is not personalistic then. It's an abstract principle. And against that, the personalist said, no, God must be personal, not abstract, not just a principle. And once again, I think as Orthodox biblical Christians, we'd want to affirm that. We don't want to have God reduced to some philosophical notion, even such a grandiose one as the absolute. We want to maintain that God is a person, even as we are persons, made in His image. Well, there are many varieties of personalism. We've just been speaking of theistic personalism, but there's also pantheistic versions of personalism. Ultimate reality is God, a personal being, and everything is that God. There are panpsychic versions of personalism, where there are little centers of consciousness, like Leibniz said, monads, that permeate the universe. Everything has some level of consciousness and personality to it. There are atheistic versions of personalism. Now that I find a little bit bizarre, but it's worthy of mention. The atheistic personalist that you want to remember, put this in your notes, is J.M.E. McTaggart, whose dates are 1866 to 1925. McTaggart represents a view that is a real minority opinion, kind of a bizarre combination here, but you do see it from time to time. He held that there is no God. He was atheistic, but he did believe in personal immortality, that in some sense our personality is ultimate and lives on after the death of our body, but there is no God. Other important names who are personalists, in addition to the two I'm going to focus on here, in France, C.B. Renouvier, in Germany, William Stern, in Russia, N.A. Berdayev, in Spain, Miguel de Unamuno, and in Britain, Hastings Rashdall and W.R. Sorley. Now, I'm not going to bother to repeat that because you'll find that listed in your textbook as well, but those are names that you should identify with this school of thought in different regions of the world. Personalism, however, was primarily an American movement, and the most popular, the best-known personalist, as I've already told you, was Gordon Parker Bowne, who published the book entitled Personalism in 1908. Following Bowne in reputation would be his students E.S. Brightman and A.C. Knudson, K-N-U-D-S-O-N. E.S. Brightman held to the view that God is finite. This is similar to John Stuart Mill. Brightman said, because of the evil in the world that God cannot overcome, but he wishes to, he has the highest of personality, goodwill, and so forth, then he must be finite in some sense. A.C. Knudson published the book Philosophy of Personalism in 1927. Both Brightman and Knudson taught at Boston University. And then repeating what I've told you, a secondary source of personalist philosophy and advocacy was the University of Southern California, which published the chief journal entitled The Personalist, beginning in 1918. Just a few years ago, by the way, the SC Philosophy Department changed the title of that journal, because it no longer represents the kind of things being published in it. The journal was edited originally by Ralph Tyler Flewelling. Well, let's just take a minute to look at a couple of personalists, and then we need to move on to more significant movements in the 20th century. Gordon Parker Bowne, 1847 to 1910, considered the founder of the movement. His main idea was that human personality is the key to reality. we come to understand what is unique about us, then we can understand reality as a whole. Everything needs to be viewed in light of human personality. He said that for an object to exist, it must either be a person, the act of a person, or the experience of a person. So persons exist, their acts, and their experiences. And when it comes to the realm of values, Bound argued that a non-personal value is almost a contradiction in terms. It's inconceivable. How could anything be a value if it's not valued? Do I have to say that again? How can it be a value if it's not valued? Well, only persons value things, and so a non-personal value would be inconceivable. The kinds of contradictions or dilemmas that philosophers have traditionally faced. How do you have unity and diversity? How can there be permanence in the midst of change? How can there be predetermination of things and yet freedom? How can there be subjective ideas and yet objective things? How can there be mechanism as well as purpose? These sorts of questions that have been on the minds of philosophers throughout the ages, according to Bound, could only be resolved on the assumption of the uniqueness of personality. You cannot reduce these dualities in the world, freedom and predetermination, permanence and change, unity and diversity, you cannot reduce one side to the other. You can't reduce unity to plurality or plurality to unity. You can't reduce change to permanence. You can't reduce permanence to change. So how do you reconcile these? Well, there is something unique which cannot be reduced to any of those other things called personality. And within personality, all those various things can be reconciled. Now again, Bound was certainly not an Orthodox Christian. He was not a presuppositionalist in the Vantillian mold. But if you just look at this formally and abstractly, there's something attractive to that. We do believe, in the end, all the philosophical problems that have been unresolved through the history of man are resolved in the personality of God, right? God is the one and the many. God is the principle of change and order, permanence, and on and on and on. And so, again, I just want to suggest that personalism is instructive, it's certainly suggestive to us of a unique perspective we as Christians want to take. We do think personal rather than impersonal reality is ultimate, and we do believe that the problems of philosophy are resolved uniquely in the personality, in the person of God Himself. And I would agree, thirdly, with the idea that it doesn't make any sense to speak of value at all unless something is valued. Now, a counterexample somebody might offer to Dr. Bahnsen would be, well, what about the value of logic? Certainly, you don't want to say logic is personal, because if logic is personal, people think, I know they're not right, but people will suggest, if logic is personal, then the laws of logic can change. So don't we want to say logic is abstract, impersonal? Well, I would say even here I would maintain a personalist approach to logic in that, first, people, human beings, the only reason that they value logic and logical consistency is because ultimately God has valued it. In a world that is impersonal, why should logic be important at all? Somebody says, well, because you have to think clearly. Then you can ask, well, why should I think clearly? So if you don't think clearly, then you can't accomplish things in this world. Why should I be caring whether I accomplish things in this world? Well, then you won't have the truth. Well, why am I under any obligation to pursue the truth? You see, all along, when we study logic, we have to study it because we believe God values logic. And we're under obligation to live our lives, especially being made in His image, in a way that's logical, that isn't yes and no, that isn't full of lies and discrepancy. And so in the end, on our view, even logic is personal. But now, does this mean that logic changes, that the laws of logic change? Well, that would only hold if we thought that the personality of God changes. You know, if God follows a certain line of thinking, I'm now speaking anthropomorphically, we actually follow His line of thinking by analogy, but if God follows a certain line of thinking, and then later says, well, no, I think different inferences should be drawn from premises like this, then God wouldn't be reliable at all. But of course, what the Bible teaches us is that God, in His character, does not change. And so making the laws of logic personal does not mean we've made the laws of logic arbitrary and subject to alteration. Well, enough said about Baun and the fundamental ideas of personalism. The second illustration that we'll look at before we move on is Josiah Royce, whose dates are 1855 to 1916. Royce argued for the notion of absolute reality or absolute mind on the basis of the possibility of error. And the argument is interesting enough that I want to mention it and get it into your notes. You'll also find it in your textbook. Everyone grants that error exists, that it's possible to make mistakes. Royce said, but if error exists, there must be a truth from which it falls or errs. Error is erring from the truth. So the possibility of error presupposes that there is a truth. But truth doesn't exist by itself. You know, out there is some kind of abstract thing in the world. You know, we don't run into truth like going through some kind of vapor cloud or something. What is truth? Well, truth is what is thought of by a mind. So if there's error, which presupposes that there's truth, then there must also be a mind which thinks that truth. There must be a mind that is conscious of that truth. But if truth is absolute, it's not contingent, as we've indicated, there must be truth, so it's necessary and absolute, then the mind which is conscious of it must be absolute truth or omniscience. Well, there's a lot of sloppiness in the expression of this argument, but I think there's something to this. Ultimately, I think we could say that you can't speak of truth and error if you don't have God's mind, the absolute omniscient mind, which is the presupposition or the context in which you say that. But Royce did not develop these insights in anything like an Orthodox Christian direction, as you might expect. He said that it's the world that's the universal mind. A universal mind that obviously transcends and extends infinitely beyond the private consciousness of any individual. So that the absolute mind, sometimes called the supreme self, includes all of us. We are all part of the absolute mind. And since all of us are persons who make up this absolute mind, we comprise what he called the great community. The great community. The great community is our larger self. The whole of humanity becomes then the what he called beloved community of God. There must be an absolute mind. It transcends our individual consciousness, and so all of us together make up the supreme mind. And from there, Royce could go on and make ethical applications. Basically, he said that loyalty is the foundational concept in all of morality. Since we all make up the great community, then ethics is based on loyalty within the great community, our human values. This thinking in the end is not very sharp or precise. It didn't win the day, but in a sense it reflected a kind of, I don't want to say mindless, that's not the word, unreflective, naive, a kind of naive humanism that was popular in the early 20th century. We should all learn to be good neighbors, should treat one another properly. There's a personal dimension to reality. Those sorts of things could, you know, that you could sell that, if I can put it crassly, because there was a spirit that was willing to buy into that outlook, even though it was not real precise philosophy. Well, with personalism, we don't exhaust the grand manner of philosophizing the 20th century. There's one other grand approach to philosophizing that we're going to be looking at in a moment. But before I get to it, I want to give you another division of schools of thought to help you organize the 20th century. One of the recurring themes in 20th century philosophy is the loss of certainty, and particularly the loss of objectivity. Many schools of 20th century thought, three major schools of 20th century thought, can be grouped together, if you will, under the common attempt to recover objectivity. The view that there's a world independent of our beliefs. A world independent of our beliefs. Obviously, process philosophy, idealistic philosophy, and personalistic philosophy, in one way or another, compromise the independence of the world that's beyond the person, beyond the consciousness, or beyond the events that comprise consciousness. And the three attempts to recover objectivity are the revival of realism, secondly, the presentation of the phenomenological method, and thirdly, the development of logical and linguistic analysis. Okay, the attempts to recover objectivity, I'll just abbreviate realism. Phenomenology. And logical linguistic analysis. All of these schools want to hold that there's a world that is independent of our beliefs, independent of our consciousness. Now let me see if I can combine these two different diagrams or category schemes that I've given you for summarizing the 20th century. I said there are some schools of philosophy which try to continue to answer in a well-balanced way the classical questions of philosophy, and I call that philosophizing in the grand manner. And you should know these, you know, by heart now. Process philosophy, idealistic philosophy, personalism. As a philosophy. The category that stands over against the grand manner schools of philosophy would be those approaches to philosophy that are mitigated in their concern. So rather than the grand manner approach, you have the mitigated concerns. The first illustration of philosophy in the mitigated form would be pragmatism or instrumentalism. It's not important that we gain certainty in the old-fashioned traditional sense. It's only important that we learn to get by in this world successfully. So philosophy has instrumental value. It doesn't have value for showing us, if you will, the absolute truth. So let me put pragmatism up here on this side of the board. And then existentialism represents a mitigated concern because the existentialist doesn't offer universal objective answers, but only those things that give authenticity to the concrete individual. So you don't have public answers anymore, you have private answers in philosophy, if you will. And then finally, the third illustration of mitigated concern that I gave you was logical and linguistic analysis. Now we just focus on very narrow things and try to get clear as to what we mean by these things and what their logical relationships would be, how they should be understood, but not giving us a systematic philosophy of life and so forth. Now the reason I put this on the board in the way that I have is that I want you to see there's one school of thought. I don't happen to endorse it. In fact, I have real problems with it. But there's one school of thought that fits both the grand manner of philosophizing and the attempt to recover objectivity. The other attempts to recover objectivity turn out to be mitigated philosophical approaches. Linguistic analysis, as I've already indicated, is over here on the side of the board that's the mitigated concerns. Realism is an early version of analysis, if you will, and so it comes over to the mitigated side as well. The realists don't present grand answers, although they're closer to that way of doing philosophy than the mitigated ones might appear. They really end up on this side of the board. So if we look at 20th century schools of thought, we put process, idealism, personalism on one side, pragmatism, realism, existentialism, analysis on the other side. There's one school of thought that attempts to recover objectivity, but it's not a mitigated philosophy. It's over here on the grand manner of doing philosophy, and that's phenomenology. Not all of the schools that are mitigated in their concern are trying to recover objectivity. Pragmatism isn't. Existentialism isn't. Linguistic analysis is. Realism is. The other school that attempts to recover objectivity, phenomenology, is a grand philosophy rather than a mitigated concern philosophy. Then one other connection between these schools of thought before we launch into realism that might be helpful for you is you can look upon phenomenology as the origin of existentialism. Existentialism turns out to be a kind of degenerated form of phenomenology. So phenomenology, as Husserl intended it, was a grand manner philosophy that would recover objectivity. But Husserl's analysis of consciousness degenerates in the existentialist to something far less than the grand manner of answering the classic questions of philosophy. And then logical and linguistic analysis, which was an attempt to recover objectivity, begins with logical atomism and logical positivism and things of that nature, The early Wittgenstein buys into that approach, but he really has a change of mind, and what's called the later Wittgenstein endorses ordinary language analysis. And so logical linguistic analysis, if you I like ordinary language analysis as an approach, so don't misread me when I say it's degenerated, but it's a degeneration of linguistic analysis into what's called ordinary language analysis. We don't want a formal or special language to clear up all our problems. We just want to be able to understand our ordinary use of words better. So I'll put up here ordinary language analysis. Ordinary language analysis stands somewhat to the early logical linguistic analytical approach as existentialism stands to phenomenology. And if I can press this parallel or comparison a little bit further, existentialism represents ultimately a kind of individual subjectivism, an individual subjectivism, like Kierkegaard, the 19th century. But here the stress is on the individual subject. Ordinary language analysis, if you will, the degenerated form of logical linguistic analysis, ordinary language analysis turns out to be a kind of social subjectivism. Many people have called it fideistic, in that there are no ultimate outside standards for evaluating any linguistic procedures or ways of speaking. Every community, that doesn't mean community like a city and a state, but every linguistic community or groupings of people have their own rules of language, you know, and how you draw inferences from things and use your words and so forth, so that everything has to be evaluated in terms of the social context of the language rather than some absolute, abstract rules of language and logic that apply to everybody in all times. And so that's a kind of social subjectivism, if you will. Well, of course, it's always more helpful when teachers give these grand overviews and combinations if you knew what each of these schools represented, because I'd like to believe there's something brilliant about what I've just, you know, said to you. But you're sitting there going, yeah, what's that all about? So if you'll remember this introductory, these introductory remarks, after we get through the 20th century, I hope you can go back and you look at that and say, oh yeah, that does help me put it all together. But let's just review what we have here on the board then. The grand manner philosophies of the 20th century, the mitigated concern philosophies of the 20th century. We can divide philosophies in that way. Process, idealism, personalism, try to do things in the grand way, and phenomenology as well. What sets phenomenology apart from the other grand manner philosophies is that it's attempting to recover objectivity, a world that's external to the consciousness of man. Now, there are other attempts to recover objectivity, realism and logical linguistic analysis, but they really are mitigated concern philosophies. It's a philosophy not in a grand systematic manner, but looking at smaller problems and trying to pay attention to them, and they go along with pragmatism, existentialism. Linguistic analysis is on this side of the board of mitigated concern, and you can see existentialism as a degenerated form of phenomenology amounting to individual subjectivism. You can look at ordinary language analysis as a degenerated form or a developed form, and maybe improved form, of logical linguistic analysis, but one that reduces to a kind of social subjectivism. Well, so let's launch into our first school of thought that attempts to recover objectivity, and that's realism, the revival of realism. the thing that all schools of realism have in common is that they stand very opposed in a very hostile way to idealism. Idealism, as it came to expression in the history of philosophy, whether you're looking at Berkeley or Hegel or F.H. Bradley, whichever version of idealism it may be, struggled with the idea that perception or experience can yield knowledge of a world that's free of the mind. The idealists were pressed by this difficulty. Since all of our experiences are mind-dependent, or if you will, all of our perceptions are mind-dependent. No one perceives anything, doesn't have a mind, a consciousness that's aware of what's being perceived. Since all of our experience and perception is mind-dependent, how can experience yield knowledge of a world that is mind-independent? How can there be a world independent of the mind if the only thing the mind ever knows, perceptions, experiences, are dependent upon the mind? And so idealism holds to the mind-dependent character of everything that's real. The realists, on the other hand, were quite opposed to that point of view, indeed considered it ultimately absurd. The thesis of realism is that physical objects exist independently of being perceived. Physical objects exist independently of being perceived. Or perhaps a better way of putting it, because that definition focuses on physical objects, realism holds that the objects of knowledge, whatever they may be, exist independently of our awareness of them. So if you believe there are non-physical objects, that as objects of knowledge, they exist independently of our awareness of them. Now, this point of view, historically, was set forth in Scotland by Thomas Reid, what we call Scottish common sense realism. That's for the sake of those who took the second course in our history sequence, Renaissance and Enlightenment. We have a short discussion of common sense realism and Thomas Reid there. Realist in the 20th century can be seen as reaffirming the outlook of common sense. If you just ask people commonly, if you just want to be commonsensical about this, is there an external world? They say yes. Now, I don't think that I'm overstepping my bounds, being too speculative here when I say it. All of you have been raised with such a mentality that you find it hard to believe that anybody could have been an idealist. Because idealism says there is no external world, everything is mind-dependent. Don't confuse that with the idealist thinking there aren't things that are hard. You know, somebody thought he refuted Berkeley once by, you know, kicking a stone. He said, there's the refutation of your idealism. The stone is not an idea. But of course, that's not a refutation at all, because what do you know about the sensation of kicking a stone? Do you know the stone? No, you know what? A sensation. And a sensation is mind-dependent. And so the experience of kicking a stone is still a mental event. Everything is mind-dependent. We don't think that way. And I was suggesting last night to Amy that when people finally get so frustrated with the history of philosophy and all of the obscurities of idealism and so forth, when people encounter philosophers who will say there is an external world and that the objects of knowledge exist apart from our being aware of them, they just latch on to that with enthusiasm. At last, something that makes sense, common sense realism. Well, I'd like to encourage you that it's just that easy, and we can pretty much put away the textbooks of philosophy, but as it usually turns out, what appears to be commonsensical isn't as easy a ride as you might have thought. So we do have to say more about this. First of all, different versions of realism that you want to have in your notes. The first one might be called representative realism. Representative realism. Representative realism holds that material objects are known not directly, but in a mediated fashion. We don't know material objects directly, but through the mediation of sense data. And so there's, if you look at any perceptual situation, there are really three things that are part of perception. The act of perception, that's what's going on inside the subject. The act of perceiving. There is the sense data, which is perceived, or which are perceived, pardon me. The sense data, which are perceived, and the objects that cause those sense data to be perceived in our act of consciousness or perception. Okay, so you have three things: the act of perceiving, the sense data which are perceived, and the objects which cause those sense data. Sense data, to define it very simply, are what is given to us immediately through perception, through the use of our senses. So that if I use my one of my senses by tasting something, the taste sense, then I have the sense data of sweetness when I put sugar in my mouth. And the sugar is thought to cause the sweetness which I perceive through my taste buds. Y'all with me? So every act of perception or experience has the object that's independent of the sugar sweet, whether I'm tasting it or not, then the sense data which is caused when I, in the act of perception or interaction with it, put it in my mouth. So representative realism holds that you have three things: an act of perception, an object that is perceived, and then that which mediates between the perception and the object, and that's the sense data. And so the representative realist held, for instance, that experience is always of mental images which copy their objects. Okay, so when I have an experience, let's just use visual illustrations now. When I have an experience of perceiving a tree, what I actually experience directly is a mental image, and that image is supposed to be a representative or copy of the tree that caused it. Okay, so this first version of realism, the very opposite of idealism, this first version, representative realism, you have to remember, holds that there is the sensing subject, if you will, the act of perceiving, that's internal. And what it is that I perceive is not the object out here directly, but the object is perceived through the mediation of sense data. And the sense data represent their objects because they are caused by their objects. The obvious problem with representative realism is what is called the egocentric predicament. The egocentric predicament. Now here's the ego, the act of perceiving, the subject of knowing, the I. Now the ego that is perceiving, the I who is perceiving, does not perceive the real object that is outside the ego or the subject. What am I perceiving? Well, on this view, I'm perceiving something called sense data. Well, now, how can I ever know that the sense data represent the object that's in the real world? Somebody might say, well, you need to stand out here, like we're looking at this board, and compare the object to the sense data. And if we do this little comparison, then we can see that the sense data do represent or copy their objects very nicely. Yes, you're all shaking your heads. That's good. We've brought you to the point where you can see through that right away. The difficulty is, on this view, perceiving is never of the object directly. It's only of sense data. So since we can never get beyond sense data, we can never really know whether the sense data are telling us about the real world beyond them and supposedly causing them. So that's a little bit of background. So you might now see the two 20th century versions of realism. Well, there are going to be a few others we'll mention, but the two primary ones early in the century are called neo-realism or new realism, and then critical realism. Let's start with neorealism, represented in a sense by G.E. Moore. I'm going to come back to talk about Moore in detail. And then the Americans, six philosophers who published in 1912 the book The New Realism, Holt, Montague, Perry, Pitkin, Spalding, and Marvin. They're in the book, so you can look them up. Holt, Montague, Perry, Pitkin, Spalding, and Marvin, The New Realist. The New Realist maintained what your textbook author calls epistemological monism, that the objects of the real world are directly presented to consciousness. Are directly presented to consciousness, and there is no intervening sense data to deal with. And the new realist held to another doctrine called neutral monism, which maintains that the kind of entity, there is a kind of entity, a neutral kind of entity that underlies both material and mental objects. A kind of pure experience, as William James would have called it, that functions both as thought and as thing. So, are there minds? Are there material things? According to the neutral monist, there's really a tertium quid, a third kind of thing, which is neutral, and sometimes in certain relationships appears as thinking, and other relationships appears as thing. Rather than thought. Perhaps the best known neutral monist was W.P. Montague. His dates are 1873 to 1953, educated at Harvard, taught at Columbia. According to Montague, error, when we're guilty of mistakes, error is taking the object of consciousness as having the mode of being that we call existence, when in fact it only has the mode of being of subsistence. There are two types of being, existence and subsistence. And when we make a mistake, it's because we have thought the object of our thinking has existence when it only has subsistence. Well, I don't have a lot of patience for this kind of talk. You know, you really have to work hard to get through the jargon and so forth. But let me give you kind of a more pedestrian explanation of this. Every time we have an object in our consciousness, it exists. But it may not exist in what we call the extramental way. It may only exist as something of an essence or a possibility of a thought. So when I'm thinking of Pegasus, I'm thinking about something that exists. Excuse me. I'm thinking of something which has being. I have to be careful here. But it doesn't have existence being. It only has subsistence being. Y'all with me? Or if you will, Pegasus has thought reality, but it doesn't have extramental reality. Well, neorealism has a number of problems. We'll see them when we come back to looking at G.E. Moore in more detail. And it will not surprise you then to hear that all of the neorealists eventually moved on to other views. Neorealism finally had no more advocates. Now, there were a group of philosophers that were critical of the neorealist very early on, and thus they're called critical realists. One thinks here of the joint venture in 1920 published as Essays in Critical Realism. Certain names you want to associate with this movement: George Santayana, Arthur Lovejoy, and Roy Wood Sellers. Roy Wood Sellers. Critical realism reaffirms representative realism. That is what I have up here on the board. They go back to that. The neorealist had wanted to get rid of the sense data and say we have some kind of direct contact with the object itself in the real world. The critical realists reassert representative realism, that there is something that mediates the object to my consciousness, and it's supposed to represent or copy that object. And then I just want to mention a couple of other very recent defenders of realism, going beyond the neorealist and critical realist debates of the early century. Two other realists that you should be familiar with: Roderick Chisholm, born in 1916. Roderick Chisholm says that statements about things, real objects, cannot be translated into statements about appearances. You cannot exhaust the meaning of a statement about a thing by simply giving us other statements about appearances. Another recent defender of realism has been Wilfred Sellers, who was born in 1912. Wilfred Sellers, who is the son of Roy Wood Sellers. So here we have philosophy being practiced in the family way. Roy Wood Sellers is a critical realist. His son grows up to be a realist of sorts as well. Wilfred Sellers called his view scientific realism. According to him, the real world contains those entities which are posited by theoretical science, if you think of science as fully developed in its ideal fashion. The real world contains the entities that theoretical science posits to be the character of the world. We do not have any direct cognitive contact with external reality, but it's the successes of science that lead us to give it a privileged position and tell us what kind of entities exist. The theoretical entities posited by science, if you idealize its successful completion, are what we should take to be the constituents of the real world. Okay. Enough on versions of realism. I now want to take one of them and give more attention to it because it has great significance in the development of logical and linguistic analysis and was perhaps the most highly regarded of all of these different versions of realism early in the century, and that's the realism proposed by the English philosopher G.E. Moore, George Edward Moore. Moore is considered a British neorealist. A British neorealist. And there are other Brits that, in a general way, fell in line with the neorealism of Moore. Samuel Alexander, about whom you've already heard in a previous lecture. Bertrand Russell for a period. Russell has moved through many phases in his outlook, but one was the neorealism of G.E. Moore, similar to it. C.D. Broad, C.E.M. Joad, J.O.A.D., H.H. Price, and A.C. Ewing, E.W.I.N.G., no relationship to Patrick, the basketball player. C.D. Broad. G.E. Moore, going back now to the object of our analysis and inspection, G.E. Moore, one of his best-known essays, perhaps one of the best-known essays of the 20th century, is entitled A Refutation of Idealism. A Refutation of Idealism, in which he maintained that idealists confuse the act of perceiving, which is mind-dependent. Notice on the board here I have the act of perceiving. Idealists confuse the act of perceiving with the object which is perceived that is not mind-dependent. And we're going to say more about the refutation of idealism, but I just want to get it in a small introductory capsule for you. Idealists confuse the act of perceiving with the object of perceiving. The act is mind-dependent. The object that is perceived is not mind-dependent. According to Moore, the sense data, which is what we perceive directly, the sense data are not merely in our consciousness. That's not correct. But rather, sense data exist objectively in the real world. Sense data are objective things that we directly encounter in the real world. What is given to us directly in perception is sense data, and the sense data is not to be confused with what is internal. It is something external. So again, using the little diagram that we have up here on the board, if a neorealist says we encounter the objects of existence directly, and as Moore says, what we are encountering is sense data, objective to our perceptions, then of course, you can bring this together. If we directly encounter objects, and that is to say we encounter sense data, then objects are what? They are constructions of sense data. So what it is out there is a combination of sense data. Crisp, spherical, sweet, red. What we call an apple is a construct of the sense data. And what I encounter, what I perceive directly, is the redness, the sweetness, the crispiness, the sphericality, whatever it is, of the object itself. So objects turn out to be constructed of sense data, which I directly perceive, right? Directly encounter. And I'm going to be critical of that view in just a moment, but I want to give you a couple of names for the sake of your notes in terms of this little introductory capsule of G.E. Moore's view. Recent critics of sense datum theory would include the analytical philosophers Gilbert Ryle and John Austin. Gilbert Ryle and John Austin, A-U-S-T-I-N. All right, let's see if we can now focus in on the development of Moore's argument against idealism in the presentation of his own view about sense data. So let me try to tell you a little bit more about Moore. The article, The Refutation of Idealism, was published in 1903, and as I told you, perhaps the most influential contribution to the revival of realism in the 20th century. Let me quote him.
Moore said, if I can refute a single proposition which is a necessary and essential step in all idealistic arguments, then no matter how good the rest of these arguments may be, I shall approve that idealists have no reason whatsoever for their conclusion. And indeed, he went on to assert that unless new reasons that have never been urged hitherto can be found, all the most important philosophic doctrines have as little claim to assent as the most superstitious beliefs of the lowest savages. So what he was not coming on in a rather humble, tentative way. He was saying, I'm going to look at a central step in the thinking of idealists, and if I can show it to be wrong, then all the other philosophical doctrines that are built on it are no better than the superstitions of the savages. And that step in the argument of the idealist that he wanted to analyze was the claim that to be, to exist, is to be experienced. Anything that exists is experienced. And Moore argued that being experienced is a quality of something, just like the color of something, another quality. And that while it is true that when I experience, let's say, a dog as brown, while it is true that there are two qualities that I experience, or if you will, the dog has these two qualities, being experienced and being brown. So these are combined in my experiencing the brownness of the dog. You cannot infer from the brownness of the dog that the dog's brownness is experienced. That is a quality similar to the quality of its color. And it's true that we have both of those things in our perception. That is, we have the being experienced and the being brown. But you cannot infer from being brown that something is being experienced as brown. What is actually present in the sensation of the dog's brownness and makes it different from the person that is sensing the dog is consciousness. And the quality of the external object does not depend upon the quality of consciousness that perceives it. So in sensation, I have consciousness and I have brown. But those two qualities don't depend upon each other. The dog can be brown without me being conscious of the brownness of the dog. And so according to Moore, there are really two distinct things which the idealist has confused as one. There's the consciousness and then the object of consciousness. According to Moore, then, there is something that we're aware of called consciousness that is clearly visible as soon as we look in the right way, look at it in the right way. As soon as experience is analyzed into its constituent parts, once the complex that we call experience is broken down, then there's something distinct from the quality of brown that we call consciousness. And those two are separate qualities. And the idealist, by confusing brown and consciousness of brown, have then the idea that the world is always mind-dependent. Now, if we could just be naive as philosophers, what I've just said to you, you could easily accept, and we'd just go home and say, that settles it. I mean, we all know this, right?
This is, as we say, common sense. The brownness of the dog is brown whether anyone perceives it or not. Brown is not mind-dependent. Consciousness is mind-dependent. That's true. But consciousness of brown is different from brown. There you have it. So there's a real world external to consciousness, external to mind. We have to ask ourselves, what is this thing called consciousness that exists as separate from the qualities or objects of the consciousness? Is that really something unambiguous? William James concluded that there is no consciousness of consciousness. Anybody who thinks that they're conscious of consciousness is just deluding himself. He's just simply mistaken. And so we have to ask more. Let me put this on the board for you. Since he says that perception breaks down into consciousness and then the object of consciousness, what you're conscious of, the brownness of the dog. Now we know the object of consciousness. You don't have a whole lot of trouble understanding what brown is or what sweet is and so forth. But what is consciousness itself? And I want to quote him. He says, "The element which I have called consciousness is extremely difficult to fix. It seems, if I may use a metaphor, to be transparent. We look through it and see nothing but the blue." He used blue in his illustration, brown in mine. Okay, so I have a consciousness of brown. Okay, now I know what brown is. What's the consciousness? And when I try to look at or consider the consciousness, he says, it's as though I look through it and all I can see are the objects of the consciousness, in this case, brown or blue. The moment we try to fix our attention upon consciousness and see what distinctly it is, it seems to vanish. It seems as if we had before us a mere emptiness. When we try to introspect the sensation of blue, all we can see is the blue. The other element is as if it were diaphanous and move through it. Yet it can be distinguished if we look attentively enough and if we know that there is something to look for. Let me read that last sentence again because that's the kicker. He says, it's very difficult to determine what this is, this consciousness that's in addition to the object of consciousness. But he says it can be distinguished if we look attentively enough and if we know that there is something to look for. Yes, well, of course, if we know that there's something to look for, maybe hard work will enable us to fix what consciousness is. But, of course, that's the whole issue, isn't it? And this may sadden you who are so willing to go home and say, enough with 20th century philosophy, we've got something we can hold on to now. But realism begs the crucial question. Realism assumes that there's something apart from the object of consciousness called consciousness, and it says, we know that it's there, and if we work hard enough, we'll be able to fix what it is. Well, but maybe you're not being clear about consciousness is just an indication that it doesn't exist, and this is just a convenient device to escape the school of thought that you didn't like.